Thanks for tuning in for the November 24th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature talk highlights an article on the neural correlates of sign language production. The second segment focuses on the headache quality measurement set. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and I'm on the phone today with Jennifer Shum. Jennifer is a neurologist at New York University's Comprehensive Epilepsy Center, and today we're discussing the paper by Jennifer and her colleagues titled Neural Correlates of Sign Language Production Revealed by Electrocorticography, which is out in this week's issue of the journal Neurology. So to our listeners, as you know, we often try to focus on articles that are immediately applicable to caring for patients in clinic. And I have to admit that I don't know any sign language except for a few words that we're trying to teach my son, like please and thank you. But we thought this article was super interesting, even if most of us don't know sign language. So Jennifer, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us about your research.
Thank you for inviting me for this interview.
So we've done quite a few podcasts this year on connectomes and networks. And before we dive into the specifics of this paper, what did you learn about networks as it pertains to spoken language versus sign language? What's the take-home message here?
So the major take-home point is that we now have a better understanding of how the brain produces sign language. And understanding sign language is important for understanding language in general because it tells us about how the brain processes language when it's used in different forms. So say an auditory vocal system for speech and the visual motor system for sign language. So we had this very unique opportunity to study sign language using intracranial electrodes in someone who was fluent in sign language as well as spoken English. And prior to this study, there was only one other case that was published in the literature, and that was almost 20 years ago. And so with this opportunity, we were able to study what regions are active and when they are active during sign production as compared to speech production. And we found that sign language and speech production recruit very distinct brain networks from each other, and that sign language recruits the superior parietal region immediately before sign production. And this suggests potentially that this region is important for planning and producing sign language. This information is important for clinicians because by understanding a specific function of the brain, such as sign language production, we can use this information to counsel patients, such as those who are undergoing a neurosurgical resection, or even helping patients who develop a lesion, such as a stroke or a tumor, and understand why they have a deficit in a specific function.
Terrific. Yeah, so I'm kind of interested about this opportunity, as you described, to this patient that you had and how this came about. Can you tell us a little bit about the background for this research you did and how this opportunity presented itself?
We had this extremely rare opportunity to study sign language in a 20-year-old gentleman who was bilingual in both English and American Sign Language. He was a child of a deaf parent, and he acquired sign language at a very young age. And he's also had focal epilepsy since he was a child that's been refractory to multiple anti-seizure medications. So he was undergoing this neurosurgical procedure to be implanted with intracranial electrodes in his left hemisphere to see if he's a candidate for either resective surgery or RNS. And I just want to emphasize that intracranial EEG is a very unique opportunity to study human cognition with very high spatial and temporal precision. And patients, such as the one in our study, are implanted with intracranial electrodes for clinical purposes to find their seizure onset zones for evaluation of potential curative epilepsy surgery. But these patients are usually bored, sitting in bed, waiting for their seizures to occur. And this is a great opportunity to have them do cognitive tasks and gain a better understanding of how the brain works. And so I want to thank this patient, as well as all of our patients who participate in our research.
So you have this patient, he is not deaf, but he's the child of a deaf adult. And so he's known sign language since he was young. And you're evaluating him for epilepsy surgery. You've implanted the electrodes. So what tasks did you ask him to perform when he had the electrodes in place?
So the task that we had him perform was a battery of 5 different language tasks, which we repeated with him responding in spoken English and then in sign language. And so we had, for these 5 different tasks, a picture naming task. So we would say, show him a picture of a balloon, and he would name the balloon with speech and then sign language. We had a word reading task. We would show him a word, balloon, and then he would read it. We had a word repetition task where he would hear a word, such as balloon, and then repeat it. And we had an auditory naming task where he would hear a description of a word, such as a rubber object you inflate with helium, and he would have to name that word. And then we had a auditory sentence completion or comprehension task where he would hear a phrase such as the clown inflated the, and he would have to complete the sentence with a word and say balloon. And the purpose of these five different tasks were to capture different types of language processing, such as naming, repetition, and comprehension. And they were given through different input modalities, such as visual inputs and auditory inputs. And as you can see, the responses were matched across the five tasks. So balloon was the response that we wanted to get with each different task. And the tasks also mirror a procedure that we do clinically, electrical stimulation mapping, which is what we use to map language and sensory motor functions to define the margins of eloquent cortex that can't be resected.
Yeah, so then let's talk once more. We've already mentioned it briefly, but what you found when you had him perform all these tasks. I know in the article you mentioned that you find some differences in the timing, the propagation, the location of signals related to sign and speech production. Can you tell us more about those findings?
We found that sign language production recruits a brain network that is very distinct from speech production. Sign recruited a more dorsal network, which involved more of the parietal and posterior temporal regions, while speech recruited a more ventral network involving more frontal and presylvian regions. There was some overlap between the two regions, and it was mainly in the perimolandic regions. We also investigated the timing of how these different brain regions are recruited, and we found that for sign production, the superior parietal region is recruited immediately before sign production. And this suggests that it's involved in planning and producing sign language, potentially similar to the way Broca's area is involved in producing speech.
Terrific. So what's next? Any plans for follow-up with this patient or any other interesting findings that we should know about?
So we have given this same battery of language tests to many other patients, though just responding in spoken English. And we hope to better understand language processing with the goal of using this information to help predict which areas of the brain are eloquent and can't be resected. And currently, the process of identifying eloquent cortex is with electrical stimulation mapping, which has its disadvantages. So we hope to understand language processing better and use the electrophysiological signal in order to give us this information.
Terrific. Well, to our audience, if you want to read more and also check out the figures in this paper, which, as we know, can be worth 1,000 words and really help illustrate the different areas of the brain that are involved in sign language production, I encourage you to check out Jennifer and her colleagues' paper. It's published in this week's issue of Neurology. Again, it's titled Neural Correlates of Sign Language Production Revealed by Electrocorticography. Jennifer, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, this is David Lapidus with the Neurology Podcast at the University of Virginia. Today, I'm joined by Matthew Robbins, Associate Professor of Neurology at Weill Cornell, where he's also the Residency Director. He's here to talk to us about his upcoming article, Quality Improvement in Neurology, Headache, Quality Measurement Set, published in this week's Journal of Neurology. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I was hopeful to actually divide up our interview by headache type. So I'll mention first that this quality improvement is an update from the 2015 quality measurement set. And a lot has happened in headache in the last 5 years, including the significant increase in use of CGRPs, the decrease in use of opioid medications. So again, I want to divide us up by headache type. And starting with migraine, what did you and the other members of this group decide are the important questions to be asking our patients regarding migraine headache?
That's a great question. And I think, yes, we've had a lot of treatment advances in recent years that include not just medications that are more migraine specific, like CGRP antibodies or acute treatments that target CGRP, but also other neuromodulation devices, behavioral therapies, where treatments might fall in for our younger patients, including children and adolescents. So a lot of this was incorporated into our algorithm for how to make the most high quality measure set for our AAN members and others. So I think for migraine specifically, you know, there's a number of core questions to ask that really might indicate high quality care for our patients. Probably the core question for migraine is about how frequent the attacks are. And there's different ways of asking about migraine attack frequency, but certainly days of headache per month or migraine monthly days, both of which are used in, say, clinical trials, are critical sort of thresholds to understand whether someone is eligible for certain type of therapies like preventative treatment. And then migraine, as grounded in neurobiology, has a huge amount of both internal and external influences on attack frequency and on how migraine might actually progress to its more chronic counterpart called chronic migraine. And we think that it's very important to address some type of modifiable lifestyle factor, many of which are also known risk factors for the transition of migraine to progress to chronic migraine. And those are the questions that we would ask about the history. And then there's, of course, questions that we would get into about treatment of migraine in terms of both how to treat the individual attacks and then when and what is indicated for preventative therapy to reduce how frequent and severe the attacks are and hopefully to induce some sort of disease remission, so to speak, in migraine in the long run.
Well, perfect. I think you're heading exactly where I was about to, namely how the different phenotypic presentations ultimately impacts the prophylactic medication or abortive therapy that you ultimately recommend. And as somebody who's put together this large quality measurement set, we would love to hear your thoughts on how things have changed for you in your practice over the last few years.
Well, I think the fact that we now have many more options for treatment has really made writing these measures sort of a great appreciation exercise in what our arsenal is to manage migraine in general. And yes, the treatments that have gotten the most attention are these designer drugs for migraine, these monoclonal antibodies to CGRP, an inflammatory neuropeptide that's important in migraine pathophysiology. And there's also acute treatments that target CGRP receptors as well. There's also a serotonin 1F receptor agonist called lasmiditan that may work like triptans, except not work on blood vessels, so have fewer contraindications. And then in addition to that, we have these neuromodulation devices that also have FDA clearance, many of which are cleared for both acute and preventative treatment for migraine. There's four such devices in that regard. And then finally, we have emerging evidence for behavioral treatments, cognitive behavioral treatment, even mindfulness that can be used for patients with migraine very successfully. And one thing that we were careful to do in our measures was not to really frame one such treatment above another, because the scientific evidence still doesn't yet support the efficacy of one treatment over the other, and every patient really requires an individualized treatment plan, especially for preventative therapy. For example, in adolescents, the evidence is most strong for behavioral treatments, whereas in adults, you know, pharmacologic therapies have better evidence. So I think there's a lot of different factors that are taken into account when a preventative therapy is applied, and we have to be even more broad about what we conceive as preventative therapies, because it may not always be medication.
Great. So a truly multidisciplinary approach, and tailoring your treatment plan on a patient-by-patient basis sounds wonderful. And I appreciate you mentioning that, you know, maybe there isn't a right answer necessarily for the group as a whole, but certainly different. And moving on to cluster headaches, so how should we be characterizing cluster headaches in our clinic visits? And then how does that impact your therapeutic recommendation?
Well, for cluster headache, there are newer treatments that we have. There has been, in recent years, one monoclonal antibody to the CGRP receptor, galcanezumab, that has been FDA approved, as well as non-invasive external vagus nerve stimulation that's been approved as both an acute treatment of episodic cluster headache and as an adjunctive preventative treatment for cluster headache. And I think for cluster headache, our quality measures are geared more towards the treatment and not just the diagnosis. And what we've done was what we made our cluster headache treatment measures a paired group of measures. What that means is that offering both acute and preventative treatment for cluster headache should be the default activity for every neurologist managing this pretty dreadful condition, although one that can really be managed well. And that's why we think the quality of care is so important for cluster headache patients, because the stakes are so high as the distress is so extreme. So what we have done is we said the default should be everyone should have a cluster headache acute treatment prescribed, and everyone should have a preventative treatment prescribed unless there was some allowable exclusion, such as, you know, the attacks have been extremely infrequent or there's a decline because of cost or access factors. But we really wanted to make imperative that a prescription should be made for a preventative treatment in addition to an acute treatment.
Great. I think that's really wonderful update. And the measurement set seems almost tailor-made to help create something like a smart phrase or a after-visit summary that you could give to a patient. Is there any thought that the AAN has, or do you have any thoughts on how a quality measurement set like you have put together with this group could help generate smart phrases for clinicians out in the community and for after-visit summary documentation so that our patients can know what to keep track of?
That is a great question. And I think that is what the AAN intends to do, not just in terms of what clinicians can do, but how it can be measured, including in AAN initiatives like the Axon Registry, to make sure these measures really can be used as both a baseline and then in follow-up to document any improvements in the quality of care that we offer. So I think in terms of how a clinician who's seeing a patient with migraine or cluster headache might frame their note in an electronic medical record, these measures provide a good foundation. So for migraine, the assessment and the plan, there could be a smart phrase that has a list of, say, factors such as, for example, in treatment, you know, the modifiable lifestyle factors. And there could be a list of such factors that is in the note. And these factors are many and could include skipping meals, caffeine consumption, exercise, smoking, stress management, sleep, hydration, you know, trigger management by using a diary, acute medication overuse, and anything else that the patient or the clinician might identify. So that would be one sort of list of bullet points that could be easily placed into a smart phrase. Certainly in the assessment, you know, what's the headache attack frequency? And in a default plan, you know, acute treatment, what is recommended? The preventative treatment, what is recommended? And if preventative treatment is not recommended, why not? So I think those sorts of things would be very useful in a smart phrase. And the same could be for cluster headache as well, to ensure, for example, as I emphasized, that a preventative treatment is always sort of the default behavior. And if it's put into an electronic medical record with a smart phrase text, that's how it becomes the default behavior in clinical practice.
Seems like a really powerful tool that you guys have put together that could easily be translated into this for neurologists across the country, and certainly would need to be modified on every individual's basis, but really puts together a nice argument for why we need specific medications for specific folks. So again, really congratulate you. One more question. Your group retired some recommendations that were felt to potentially overburden doctors who manage refractory or complicated headache patients like yourself. So does that reflect that the community is doing a better job not prescribing opiates and barbiturates, or perhaps that we're actually having some improved efficacy in the treatment of these patients with our new therapeutic arsenal?
That is a great question. I think part of why we retired certain measures, one was that there were several measures in the prior set that were founded in with good reasoning on medication overuse. And, you know, the concept of medication overuse is when acute medications are used by some definition in excess. And the International Headache Society has a classification system that defines thresholds for that. And then medication overuse headache is what happens when the excessive use of acute medications leads to the index headache disorder worsening. But what we thought was that the emphasis would be better framed and a bit more patient-centric and perhaps less stigmatizing to patients if we framed acute medication overuse in the context of its index headache disorder, which is almost always migraine and chronic migraine. So what we did was we incorporated medication overuse into the different measures, including acute medication prescribed, including the lifestyle factors that should require counseling. So we thought that it just fit better and was less stigmatizing to have all of these different measures on medication overuse, because it's a controversial topic. And even when I'm counseling a patient in my office about the concept of medication overuse, you always feel a bit sheepish talking about it, because you're saying, well, you're taking this medication too much, even though I prescribed it for you in the first place, and now it's making you worse. We think that it should be better contextualized with migraine. And then the other question is that, you know, neurologists commonly see patients with migraine who do have acute medication overuse. And we thought that if you had so many measures that just use that as a marker, it could potentially penalize not just the headache specialist like I am, but the general neurologist who's seeing migraine very commonly in a broad range of disease severity. But even so, chronic migraine and medication overuse is overrepresented in general neurology practices. And we thought that it would just be better contextualized within a migraine umbrella first.
Great. So really to decrease the potential patients feeling judged by the terminology that we're using. I always admit to potentially using too much naproxen myself for my migraines whenever I start talking about medication overuse headache, but this is really, really helpful. So again, we've been speaking with Matthew Robbins, Associate Professor of Neurology at Weill Cornell, about the upcoming Quality Improvement in Neurology Headache Quality Measurement Set published in this week's Journal of Neurology. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Jose Merino. Please take a look at this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.